Of all the books of history I have read, my favorite scene takes place on April 12, 1945, 80 years to the day this coming Erev Pesach. And my favorite description of this scene can be found in David McCullough's biography of Harry Truman. At this point, Vice President Truman had been put on the presidential ticket, largely because he balanced it, and it had happened at the Democratic National Convention, originally over his protestations. As vice president, Truman had little contact with President Roosevelt, who at this point bestrode the world like a colossus. Roosevelt did not seem to consider the possibility that he was mortal, and he did little to involve his vice president in planning all the unprecedented aspects of the war, the future of all of Europe, and the creation of the atomic bomb. Harry Truman spent most of his time in this position, not in the White House, but in the Capitol, presiding over the Senate. On this day, as McCullough describes, Truman had left the Senate chair, evaded his Secret Service guard, and went to the beloved location in the Capitol where the House Speaker, Sam Rayburn, would host a bit of imbibing in order to bring the day to a close. There, Truman received a message that he must call the White House, and without being given any information, he was told urgently to travel down Pennsylvania Avenue to the presidential residence right away. Here is how David McCullough describes it in what is probably my favorite book of history. Quote, "He went out the door alone. Then he began to run, taking a different route. He kept to the ground floor this time, racing down a hall between a double line of bronze and marble Civil War generals and forgotten state governors, his shoes pounding on the marble floor. He ran through the echoing old crypt, past the Senate barber shop, then up a flight of chairs with brass banisters to his office to get his hat. He told Harry Vaughan that he was on his way to the White House and to keep that to himself. In minutes, he was in the big Mercury with Tom Hardy driving, but still no Secret Service guard, moving with all possible speed through the evening traffic. By now, it was approximately 5:15 p.m. What thoughts were rushing through his mind, he never fully revealed. I thought I was going down there to meet the president, he later said. I didn't allow myself to think anything else. To his mother, he would write, it occurred to him that perhaps Roosevelt had returned from Warm Springs because the retired Episcopal Bishop of Arizona, an old friend of the president's, had been buried that day. I thought that maybe he wanted me to do some special piece of liaison work with the Congress and had sent for me to see him after the funeral. But if this was so, McCullough continues, why had he run back to his office? I ran all the way, he told her. What did he imagine he was running toward or leaving behind? At the White House, the long black car turned off Pennsylvania through the Northwest Gate and swept up the drive, stepping under the North Portico. The time was 5:25. Two ushers were waiting at the door. They took his hat and escorted him to a small, oak-paneled elevator, more like an ornate cage that had been installed in the Theodore Roosevelt era. And that ascended now very slowly to the second floor. In the private quarters across the center hall in her sitting room, Mrs. Roosevelt was waiting. With her were Steve Early and her daughter and son-in-law, Anna and John Bettinger. Mrs. Roosevelt stepped forward and gently put her arm on Truman's shoulder. Harry, the president is dead. Truman was unable to speak. Is there anything I can do for you? He said at last. Is there anything we can do for you? She said. For you are the one in trouble now. So McCullough writes, why am I so entranced by this scene of a man who has suddenly become the most powerful person on earth, running, while he knows not why, stopping suddenly to retrieve his hat? The scene is entrancing because it captures how in history, a seemingly random chain of events can change the world forever. Events which only in retrospect, one can find therein the plan of providence. No one, even when he was in the Senate, could have predicted that Harry S. Truman would one day be the president during the presidency's most powerful moment in history up to that point, so that he would engage in decisions such as dropping the atomic bomb, overseeing the future of Europe, and installing the Marshall Plan, not to mention the Korean War, the integration of the military, and the firing of MacArthur. And of course, the shock of Truman suddenly rising to the presidency was compounded by the fact that Roosevelt had been in the White House for so long that many Americans could not conceive of anyone else in the position. And Truman, safe to say, was nothing like the man he replaced. FDR was patrician from the most famous political family in America. In contrast, if we wish to get a sense of Truman, we can look to one of the funniest scenes in David McCullough's book, in which the president's daughter Margaret, a singer, receives a terrible review from the Washington Post critic Paul Hume. At this point, Margaret Truman is an adult. Harry Truman, her father, is president of the United States. If a singer gets a bad review, that's part of the job, comes with the career. The president, one would think, should stay out of it. McCullough tells us, quote, "It was the timing of the review in the Post, more than what Paul Hume had said, that caused Truman to explode. If it hadn't been the review, it might have been something else, given the stress he was under and his grief. In the Blair House study on a White House memo pad, he began what was to be his most notorious, long-hand spasm of all, a seething 150-word letter to Hume that he sealed in an envelope, addressed, fixed with a 3-cent stamp, and carried with him over to the White House. To an elderly White House messenger named Samuel Mitchell, Truman asked if it was not an especially pleasant day. When Mitchell agreed, Truman suggested that he might like to take a stroll outside and on his way drop a letter in a mailbox on the street. Had Charlie Ross still been on duty," this is one of Truman's aides, "the letter might have been stopped in time. Seeing the review, Ross would have known at once what Truman's response would be." But, so McCullough writes, but then as he goes on to describe, Charlie Ross was not on the job. And so you have to imagine the President of the United States, still overcome with anger, walking out of the White House and mailing, you have to imagine Truman giving his aide, giving a person in the White House a letter and walking out, and that letter is mailed. McCullough further tells us that though Hume and his editor at the Post decided to do nothing about the president's letter, copies were apparently made, and in short order it appeared in full on page one of the tabloid, Washington News. And this is the letter that the President of the United States sent to the Washington Post critic. "Mr. Hume, I've just read your lousy review of Margaret's concert. I've come to the conclusion that you are an 8-ulcer man on 4-ulcer pay. It seems to me that you are a frustrated old man." McCullough interjects with the point that Paul Hume was 34 years old. He writes, Hume was 34. But Truman wrote, "It seems to me that you are a frustrated old man who wishes he could have been successful. When you write such poppycock as was in the back section of the paper you work for, it shows conclusively that you're off the beam and at least 4 of your ulcers are at work. Someday," this is the President of the United States, "someday I hope to meet you. When that happens, you'll need a new nose, a lot of beefsteak for black eyes, and perhaps a supporter below." And then he wrote of another writer, another columnist that he hated, Westbrook Pegler. And he added, "Pegler, a guttersnipe, is a gentleman alongside you. I hope you'll accept that statement as a worse insult than a reflection on your ancestry." End quote. Now, ladies and gentlemen, today it is perhaps not shocking to ponder the notion of a political figure engaging adversarially with a writer for the Washington Post. But in this particular point in history, it was largely unheard of. It was a shock. So one could not find someone less like FDR in personality and gestalt. And yet, as David McCullough shows us through his wonderful writing, this seemingly common man made decisions on instinct that were profoundly controversial at the time. Decisions, many of which history looks favorably on today. One of these, of course, concerned the future of the Jewish people and the Jewish state. There is therefore no better day to consider McCullough's biography than this evening, for at the heart of the story of Purim, which we will celebrate soon, is a story of seeming series of coincidental events that are actually part of a providential plan. And that, I think, we can see in the tale of Truman and Israel, and especially in the incredibly small details of the story. It is to this that I turn, hoping that it will provide us perspective for Purim, and thereby make our holiday more meaningful. We start during World War I, when Lieutenant Truman, stationed in an army training camp in Oklahoma, was given a striking assignment to run the regimental canteen. And he takes on someone else to help him. David McCullough writes, "In addition to his regular duties, he had been assigned to run the regimental canteen, a dispensary for candy, sodas, cigarettes, tobacco, shoelaces, writing paper. And it was this that soon made him known to nearly everyone in camp." And then he adds, "To help make the operation a financial success, as most army canteens were not, Harry took on a partner, Sergeant Edward Jacobson, a former clerk in a Kansas City clothing store. I have a Jew in charge of the canteen by the name of Jacobson, and he is a crackerjack," he told Bess, "as if," writes McCullough, "that were all the reason anyone would need to expect a profitable outcome." And it was indeed Jacobson who ran things, McCullough continues, as Harry was always first to acknowledge. They became fast friends. "Each day, Harry would write a letter to his girl, Bess Wallace," Jacobson remembered, "and I would write one to my sweetheart, Bloomer Rosenbaum. And when I went into town," McCullough explains, "to replenish supplies, I would mail them." Harry had brought the staffer to camp and had it stripped down to serve as a truck. "The bright red car," he writes McCullough, "with Truman at the wheel, Jacobson behind him, became a familiar sight rolling through camp, trailing a column of dust. To finance the canteen, every man in the regiment was assessed $2, which produced an instant capitalization of $2,200. In no time, Truman and Jacobson had a grand rushing business taking in $500 to $900 a day. A barber shop and a tailor shop were added. After 6 months, business was so successful overall that the canteen paid dividends of $10,000, which made Truman and Jacobson extremely popular and led them to conclude that they were an unbeatable team. Some of the other officers began kidding Harry, calling him a, quote-unquote, lucky Jew and, quote-unquote, Trumanheimer. I guess I should be very proud of my Jewish ability," he said, end quote. After the war, as McCullough later describes, these two partners decided to open a haberdashery business. And this, unlike the canteen, totally failed. And it is safe to say that had the shirt store in Missouri, run by Jacobson and Truman, proven a success, the story of America and perhaps of the Jewish people would be very different indeed. For we can fast forward almost three decades with Harry Truman, the failed haberdasher, who, not having any other marketable skills, decided, of course, to go into politics, became a member of the Missouri political machine, and suddenly became, through a series of unlikely events, the heir to Franklin Roosevelt and then President of the United States on April 12th, 80 years ago. In 1947, the United Nations had approved the partition plan, but in early 1948, the American delegation under the leadership of Secretary of State George Marshall sought to revert to a UN trusteeship for the area. Harry Truman revered Secretary Marshall more than he admired any man on earth. And at this point, feeling that many Zionist leaders had been disrespectful to him, Truman refused to meet with said leaders, who were desperate to get an audience, terrified that through the leadership and influence of the United States, the hope for an independent Jewish state being born would suddenly evaporate. One man who came to the United States specifically for the purpose of meeting Truman was Chaim Weizmann. Meanwhile, in the face of Marshall's opposition to the birth of a Jewish state, Truman's Jewish friend and former partner, Eddie Jacobson, pleaded with the president to to meet Weizmann. The president agreed and the two met on March 19th. Then, the next day, to Truman's shock, it is this story that we are going to tell, this meeting. How did it come about? Eddie Jacobson, the only Jew with walk-in privileges to the White House, was asked by Zionist leaders to plead on Weizmann's behalf. And we are told by McCullough that Eddie Jacobson headed over to the White House, across the street from the Statler Hotel, and asked if he could check in on his old friend, Harry Truman. They told him that he absolutely can meet him. Truman loved to see his friends, as long as he promised not to bring up the situation in the Middle East. Eddie Jacobson promised, and then walked into the Oval Office and immediately brought up the situation in the Middle East. Here is McCullough's description, probably after the scene of Truman becoming president, my favorite one in his book, again written as only McCullough could. Quote, Truman, suddenly tense and grim-faced, responded in hard, abrupt fashion. Not at all like himself, Jacobson thought. In all the years of our friendship, he never talked to me in this manner, or in any way even approaching it, Jacobson would remember. Truman later told Clark Clifford he was not angry at Jacobson, so much as at the people who were using Jacobson to get to him. He had no wish to talk about Palestine or the Jews or the Arabs or the British, Truman said. He would leave that to the United Nations. He spoke bitterly of the abuse he had been subjected to, of how, quote-unquote, disrespectful and mean certain Jews had been to him. Jacobson thought suddenly and sadly that, my dear friend, the President of the United States, was at that moment as close to being an anti-Semite as any man could possibly be. Jacobson tried arguing back. I am now surprised at myself that I had the nerve, he later wrote. But Truman was unmoved. Jacobson, McCullough continues, felt crushed. On a table to the right against the wall was one of the president's prized possessions, a small bronze of Andrew Jackson on horseback, the model of the statue by Charles Keck that Truman had commissioned for the Jackson County Courthouse in Kansas City. Jacobson had noticed it on other visits, but now pointing to it, he found himself making an impassioned speech. Harry, and we should note, as I quote this, the astounding fact that Eddie Jacobson is meeting the President of the United States and is calling him Harry, which I think he did not usually do. Harry, all your life you have had a hero. I too have a hero, a man I never met, but who is, I think, the greatest Jew who ever lived. I am talking about Chaim Weizmann. He is a very sick man, almost broken in health, but he traveled thousands of miles just to see you and plead the cause of my people. Now you refuse to see him, just because you are insulted by some of our American Jewish leaders, even though you know that Weizmann had absolutely nothing to do with these insults and would be the last man to be party to them. It doesn't sound like you, Harry, because I thought you could take the stuff they have been handing out. And then McCullough writes, I think hysterically, as Abba Ibn later wrote, the comparison between Weizmann and Andrew Jackson was unimaginably far-fetched. I should just interject here to say that one cannot conceive of two people less like each other than Andrew Jackson and Chaim Weizmann. Continues McCullough, and it worked. Truman began drumming his fingers on the desk. He wheeled around in his chair and with his back to Jacobson sat looking out at the window into the garden. For what to Jacobson seemed like centuries. Neither of them said anything. Then, swinging about and looking Jacobson in the eye, Truman said what Jacobson later described as the most endearing words he had ever heard. You win, you bald-headed SOB. I will see him. And then McCullough concludes, from the White House, Jacobson walked directly across Lafayette Square and up 16th Street, so it's a little further than across the street, to the bar at the Statler, where, as never before in his life, he downed two double bourbons. End quote. I love this scene, and not just because I really like double bourbons. It is one which brings to mind Mordechai's exhortation to Esther that we will read tomorrow evening. Mi yodea im la'et kazot. Who knows, perhaps for this very moment, you have been put in this position. One moment can change the future, as long as we recognize that Providence has set the stage for it. And in hindsight, studying this famous moment, we can see how other events brought it about. But first, let us consider what happened next. Marsh Weitzman saw the president. In the end, the next day, to Truman's great shock, the representative at the UN announced a support for a trusteeship instead of a partition plan. But in the end, that is not what occurred, and Truman's own support for partition continued. And he ultimately, of course, recognized the State of Israel again over the vociferous objections of his Secretary of State. Now, in many Zionist accounts of the tale of Truman, Israel, and Jacobson, it is Jacobson's role that is seen as critical to Truman's ultimate support for partition and for a Jewish state. That is certainly the perspective given to us by David McCullough. There are those today that challenge the account that McCullough and others give us. First and foremost, perhaps, Walter Russell Mead, the writer, foreign policy expert, and historian, in his book, The Ark of a Covenant. Mead questions Jacobson's role, given that Truman never officially recanted what his own UN representative had announced, and the fact that he allowed that delegation to continue, seemingly, at the United Nations. Let's consider Mead's critique. Mead writes, "No official record of the meeting exists, and neither Weitzman nor Truman ever gave a full account of what was said." And then he adds, "Many writers, both pro and anti-Zionist, have seen the March meeting between the two leaders as equally consequential." "That seems unlikely," Mead writes. "As we've noted, Truman's policy did not change after meeting with Weitzman." And then he adds, "Following Austin's UN speech," that's the UN representative, "the United States continued to oppose partition and support alternatives right up until May 14th, end quote. Now, it is true that the UN representative did oppose partition in the UN, but still, is Mead right? He is an exceptional scholar and a brilliant writer. And my own cards on the table about my particular biases, ladies and gentlemen, I am profoundly formed by the book that I read as a young man, a book that in many ways was the one that made me fall in love with reading history. But at the same time, I have sought, in writing and in speaking, to defend McCullough's version. As I documented in commentary, from which this portion of my presentation draws, while it is true, as Mead writes, that there wasn't an official record of the meeting between Truman and Weitzman, the various accounts of what actually occurred, both during that meeting and afterwards, has been assiduously documented by Alice and Ronald Radush in their excellent book, A Safe Haven, Harry S. Truman and the Founding of Israel. There we are told that Chaim Weizmann's wife, Vera, recorded in her diary, immediately after the meeting, that Truman had told her husband that he still, quote unquote, supported partition. Truman's assistant, Clark Clifford, who is really one of the heroes of the story of Truman and the Jews, also reported, according to the Radosh book, that following Austin's announcement at the United Nations, Truman was, quote, "as disturbed as I have ever seen him," end quote. And Clifford added that, quote, "I assured Chaim Weizmann," and Clifford added that Truman said, "I assured Chaim Weizmann that we were for partition and would stick to it. He must think I'm a plain liar." Moreover, ladies and gentlemen, as McCullough himself points out, I believe, we have Truman's diary from the moment that his own UN representative opposed partition. This is what Truman wrote. "This morning I find that the State Department has reversed my Palestine policy. The first I know about it is what I see in the papers. I am now in the position of a liar and a double-crosser. I've never felt so in my life. There are people on the third and fourth levels of the State Department who have always wanted to cut my throat. They've succeeded in doing it." So there you have a quote. I may have perhaps left out one word here, but you have Truman feeling betrayed. This was not his policy. And the Radashes further point out in their book that in an April 12th meeting with Jacobson, meeting almost a month after Truman's meeting with Weizmann, the president, according to Eddie Jacobson's recollection, quote, reaffirmed very strongly the promises he had to Dr. Weizmann and me, and he gave this, he had made to Dr. Weizmann and me, and he gave me permission to tell Dr. Weizmann so. End quote. Presidential speechwriter Sam Rosenman, we are also told in by the Radosh book, was then sent to Weizmann to tell him that in a meeting with the president, Truman's first words were, quote, I have Dr. Weizmann on my conscience. So I think all this indicates that even as Marshall, Secretary of State, and his representative at the UN sought to undo partition, at the same time, the President of the United States was operating independently against them. Or as the Radoshes put it in their book at the time that, quote, the State Department's proposals were floundering at the United Nations, the President was going in another direction, end quote. I am therefore, as I wrote in commentary, more sympathetic than meat is to McCullough's account, which is the traditional account, which is that while Truman did not feel he could openly oppose his own State Department without looking very, very weak as a head of state, Weizmann played an important role, if not the only one, in sustaining Truman's support for partition, which means, ladies and gentlemen, that Eddie Jacobson in his own, who knows, but for this moment you were put in your position situation, played a very important role in the story of the State of Israel, which means, of course, that the seemingly random fact that he was stationed with Lieutenant Harry Truman, and the seemingly random fact that their canteen succeeded, and the seemingly random fact that their haberdashery store failed, all played an important role in the story of the Jewish state. Walter Russell Mead himself notes that when it came to the second time that President Truman overruled Secretary Marshall on May 12th, when Truman decided to recognize Israel as an independent state, there, Mead concedes, as I wrote further in commentary, that the meeting with Weizmann did impact Truman. But very interestingly, Mead notices and suggests another motivation that Truman might have had to ultimately ignore Marshall. He writes, quote, keeping the Democratic Party united as he led the country into a Cold War with the Soviet Union was the big goal Truman never lost sight of. Aligning his Palestine policy as far as possible with the liberals who wanted the issue resolved by the United Nations was one of the ways in which he achieved it, end quote. Meaning that there were prominent people in the Democratic Party that supported partition plan and an independent Jewish state. And, as Mead notes, as hilarious as this might seem today, part of why these liberal members of the Democratic Party supported partition and the birth of an independent Jewish state was because such an event would vindicate the faith they had placed in the United Nations. In other words, as Mead points out, essentially the organization that we identify today perhaps more than any other, with Israel hatred, was actually one of the central factors in bringing about Truman's support for Israel's birth. As Mead describes, and this does not contradict McCullough's account, but I think actually can be taken together in tandem with it, Eleanor Roosevelt was profoundly invested in the future of the United Nations. And with Truman running for re-election, he certainly did not want to run afoul of her. So, ladies and gentlemen, one can actually say in a striking way that faith in the future of the United Nations as an organization played a real role in the story of the birth of Israel. Thus, we can say that just as Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik and Paul Johnson have noted how the actual vote on partition in the United Nations can be seen as providential and miraculous, so too can all the details of this story, some described by McCullough, some described by Walter Russell Mead, the role played by Eleanor Roosevelt and her faith in the United Nations, and the role played by Eddie Jacobson and his friendship from World War I with his co-canteen manager, Harry Truman. All this comes together for a series of moments in which roles were played that made a massive impact on the future of the Jewish people and the Jewish state. For, ladies and gentlemen, as I reflected in commentary, let us consider, had FDR been president in 1948 instead of Harry Truman, would he have had the same motivations? He certainly was not friends with a Jew with whom he had been in the haberdashery business. I think that is safe to say. And, of course, at the end of his fourth term, I think we can confidently assert that he would not have been worried about the future of the Democratic nomination and the election in the same way that Harry Truman was. David McCullough, in his own book, describing those who had fought against Marshall within the administration, tells us the following, quote, "The two ardent champions of the Jewish cause on the White House staff were Clark Clifford and David K. Niles, Truman's special assistant for minority affairs. Niles, one of the holdovers from the Roosevelt years, and himself a Jew, sensed in Truman a fundamental sympathy for the plight of the Jews that he had never felt with Roosevelt. Had Roosevelt lived, Niles later said, things might not have turned out as they did," end quote. And we, so McCullough tells us, and we might add, things might have turned out very differently had any number of things happened. Had the business of Truman and Jacobson succeeded, then Truman would never have gone into politics. And whoever actually became the vice president and then president when FDR would have died in office would have been somebody else entirely, who might have felt very differently about the Jews and the Jewish state. Let us consider what might have happened had Jacobson and Truman had a falling out. As someone from Missouri, whom I know, once put it to me, he said something to the extent of, if Jacobson had not treated Truman well in their business together, who knows what might have happened to the future of the state of Israel today. McCullough, in his book, describes Truman overriding his Secretary of State, his hero, Marshall, one of the most influential statesmen on earth. And he explains, citing Truman himself, why Truman found it within himself to do so. McCullough writes, and he's quoting Truman, "The difficulty with many career officials in government," he would later write, "is that they regard themselves as the men who really make policy and run the government. They look upon the elected officials as just temporary occupants. Every president in our history has been faced with this problem, how to prevent career men from circumventing presidential policy." And then McCullough adds another part of the quote from Truman. "Some presidents have handled the situation by setting up what amounted to a little State Department of their own. President Roosevelt did this and carried on direct communications with Churchill and Stalin. I," Truman wrote, "did not feel that I wanted to follow this method because the State Department is set up for the policy of handling foreign policy operations, and the State Department ought to take care of them. But I wanted to make it plain that the President of the United States, and not a second or third echelon in the State Department, is responsible for making policy." These are Truman's words. And then McCullough adds in his book about Truman, "He felt great satisfaction in what he had been able to do for the Jewish people and was deeply moved by their expressions of gratitude then and for years to come. When the chief rabbi of Israel, Isaac Halevi Herzog, called at the White House, he told Truman, 'God put you in your mother's womb so you would one day be the instrument to bring the rebirth of Israel after 2,000 years. I thought he was overdoing things,' remembered David Niles. 'But when I looked over at the president, tears were running down his cheeks,'" end quote. This, of course, ladies and gentlemen, is a story that it's hard to imagine if the various series of events that I have described did not take place regarding the haberdashery business, as well as Jacobson's choice to actually walk into the Oval Office at this moment. This, of course, does not mean that this was the only incredible occurrence in the story of the birth of Israel. After all, Truman himself did not feel that he had the political capital to undo the arms embargo that the State Department wanted over the Middle East. And strikingly, as both Rabbi Soloveitchik and Paul Johnson pointed out, Israel's survival is also linked to the fact that Stalin took a brief break from his genocidal anti-Semitism to allow Czechoslovakia to sell materiel to the Jews in the Middle East. But the sheer unlikelihood of all that unfolded is what makes the story unforgettable, even more so when one sees it through the lens of McCullough's lyrical prose. No one, or very few, thought Truman could succeed Roosevelt. McCullough describes all the people aghast when they suddenly realized who was in charge of the American government in the middle of World War II. But McCullough does cite one friend of Truman who, seeing his old partner become president, said something to the effect of, "I wish everyone could know him as I do." And I have to say that the truth is, for me, Truman is much more appealing than his predecessor. McCullough writes in the conclusion of the biography how the common touch of Truman was actually a gift. Quote, "Ambitious by nature, he was never torn by ambition, never tried to appear as something he was not. He stood for common sense, common decency. He spoke the common tongue. As much as any president since Lincoln, he brought to the highest office the language and values of the common American people. He held to the old guidelines. Work hard, do your best, speak the truth, assume no airs, trust in God, have no fear. Yet he was not and had never been a simple, ordinary man. The homely attributes, the Missouri wit, the warmth of his friendship, the genuineness of Harry Truman, however appealing, were outweighed by the larger qualities that made him a figure of world stature, both a great and good man and a great American president." And then McCullough cites something that Admiral King said to a British lord while they were at Potsdam. "Watch the president. This is all new to him, but he can take it. He is a more typical American than Roosevelt, and he will do a good job." Again, the quote. "He is a more typical American than Roosevelt, and he will do a good job." McCullough continues, "With his ability to take it, his inner iron, his bedrock faith in the democratic process, his trust in the American people, and his belief that history was the final all-important judge of performance, he was truly exceptional. He had never had a doubt about who he was, and that too was part of his strength, as well as the enjoyment of life he conveyed. He was the kind of president the founding fathers had in mind for the country. He came directly from the people. He was America. In his time, in his experience, from small town to farm, to World War in far-off France in 1918, from financial failure after the war to the world of big city machine politics, to the revolutionary years of the New Deal in Washington, to the surge of American power during still another terrible World War, he had taken part in the great chronicle of American life as might have a character in a novel. There was something almost allegorical about it all. The man of independence and his odyssey. The lesson of Truman's life," said Senator Adlai E. Stevenson, 3rd of Illinois, "was a lesson about ourselves, an object lesson in the vitality of popular government, an example of the ability of this society to yield up from the most unremarkable origins the most remarkable men." End quote. This is excellent. But the best, perhaps, was put by Norman Podhoretz when he was very young in a review and commentary of Truman's memoir. Norman wrote, quote, "We can see quite another moral significance in his career when we contemplate the fact that this extraordinary man, who has probably done more than anyone else to keep the world alive on the edge of an apocalypse, was able to emerge into greatness only by becoming, in his own eyes and in the eyes of the nation, a perfect symbol of the average American." End quote. The story of Truman is a tale of America, one which also profoundly impacted the Jewish future. And it is therefore an inspiration as we celebrate Purim and pray for more reflections of providence yet to come.